God is King. There's a hymn, and we'll sing it later. Rejoice, the Lord is King. And it includes this verse. His kingdom cannot fail. He rules all earth and heaven. And the keys of death and hell are to our Jesus given. Wonderful words, aren't they? Well, that might be said to be the story of Esther that we've got here. That actually God is sovereign. That God is King. The story of Esther is a story about, you could say it's about coincidences. You know, God overruling government, God overruling politics, and just putting the right person in the right place at the right time. Evil seems to reign, but actually God's at work. And it's a story of faith, trusting that God's at work when everything seems to go wrong. We started last week, and let me just recap what we looked at. The action takes place not when the Jews are in exile in Babylon, but in the Persian Empire, where Xerxes is the emperor. This is a little while after the time of Daniel, a bit before the time of Nehemiah. Some of the Jews have gone back. They've gone back to Israel, but quite a few are still in exile. And Xerxes rules this massive empire. The Persian Empire goes from Greece all the way to India and from Afghanistan down to Egypt. And he's fallen out with his wife. He holds a banquet and falls out with her, acquires a new wife, and that's Esther. Our story picks up with Esther winning the competition and becoming the new queen. And it's a story of pride, plotting, and pleading. First of all, pride. Pride, Haman versus Mordecai. After all these events, one of the king's servants, civil servants, Haman, gets promoted. Effectively, he becomes the head of the civil service. He becomes the prime minister. And everyone is required to acknowledge Haman's position by coming and kneeling down before him. I think that probably was the normal practice in the Persian Empire. However, Mordecai, that's Esther's cousin, for some reason, refuses to do this. So a delegation of royal officials are sent to him and say, Mordecai, why won't you bow down and kneel before Haman? Everyone else does it. But despite being constantly badgered for days on end, he won't bow down, he won't kneel before him. Why is that? The passage doesn't really give us a reason, it's a precise reason. One idea is that maybe Haman was an Agite, it says that. This is a tribe that had fought King Saul. King Saul was a Benjamite from the tribe of Benjamin, as was Mordecai. You know, and so maybe Saul's conflict with King Agag 600 years ago was being replayed in the Persian court. And it wasn't Saul versus Agag. Today it was Mordecai versus Haman. Maybe. But that had happened 600 years previously, so I'm not really sure that's a realistic reason for Mordecai not to bow down. Look for a minute about what happens when Mordecai doesn't do this. Verse 5. Haman becomes enraged. And a normal person might say, well, I'll just punish Mordecai. Go to prison for a month or something. But Haman is enraged. You know, and it's like a line of dominoes falling down. You know, this one small thing sets off a chain reaction which is going to have catastrophic effects. And Haman doesn't say, I'll just put him in prison, but I'm going to eliminate all the Jewish people entirely. You know, the implication is that Mordecai's action is, he's proud. He's stubborn. It's not wrong to respect authority. Every time the mayor visits, I get a sheet of instructions, you know, telling me how to greet the mayor. There's a kind of protocol for it. Actually, people are very relaxed about it. But it's saying there's a right way to do it. You know, I think in his culture, Mordecai is not being asked to do something probably that's not unreasonable. And in contrast, you look at Esther, she seems to follow all the right protocol of the Persian court. You know, some might seem very formal. Esther fits in and God works. Mordecai refuses to fit in and he creates near disaster. Paul, when he's writing to the Roman Christians in the book of Romans, they live in an oppressive, evil empire, but he advises the believers this. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. You know, it's good to have rights. You know, but if we stand on our rights too much, sometimes it creates conflicts. You can see that with neighbours and families, where if people have an argument and they refuse to back down, they refuse to compromise. They're proud. Was this the case with Mordecai? It doesn't say it explicitly, it sort of leaves the question open. But on balance, I think that was a problem. Mordecai was proud. That's Mordecai. What about Haman, his adversary? Well, Mordecai might have been proud, but Haman definitely was. And worse than that, he was poisonously proud, so much that he's willing to destroy anyone who gets in his way. If he'd been wise, he might have overlooked Mordecai's offence. He might have punished him, as I said, put him in prison for a month. But rather, his reaction is completely over the top. Verse 6. He scorned the idea of only killing Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews. His kind of reaction makes his supposed power look a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? If he can't cope with one obstructive person who won't do one simple thing, not respecting him, what sort of man is he? He's actually not very powerful, but in reality he's very weak. He's very stupid. Can you see how this story might have encouraged the Jews when they're in exile? Imagine it. They live under pagan governments. You know, sometimes it's hostility to their faith. Sometimes it's dangerous. They haven't got much power. They're a minority. They're at the bottom of the pile. The rulers seem powerful and invincible and untouchable. It's possible to feel fatalistic. Life is bad, nothing will change, it will always be bad. But this story shows up the rulers. Xerxes and Haman, they both have great power, but they don't actually handle it very well. They might rule kingdoms, they might command armies, they might have vast budgets, but they can't rule human hearts. They look powerful, but when you look closer at them, actually they're very weak and very stupid. They rule nations, but they can't control their own tempers. And so you can see that Esther, the book of Esther, is kind of, it's subversive. It's a socially subversive tract for people living under a dictatorship. It would be a great encouragement to them. These people seem powerful. Look at them. They're stupid. Actually, they're really weak. Where does the real power lie? That's the pride. And then there's the plot, verse 7 to verse 15. Haman wants to get rid of the Jews. He wants to totally annihilate them. So what does he do? Think carefully, plan carefully. No, the first thing he does actually is slightly irrational. He goes and trusts to luck. And he spends some time drawing lots. You can see it, verse 7. They draw lots. In fact, they draw lots of lots, and eventually it falls on the 12th month. In other words, it's as far away as possible in time from when they started drawing them. You can see God's hand there. It might seem like superstition, but God arranges things to give the Jewish people the maximum amount of time to do something about this planned massacre. Verse 7 can be translated, and it is in some versions, like the Revised Standard Version. They cast the lot before Haman day after day, month after month. It implies they kept pulling out straws or shaking dice or whatever until they got the right answer. And verse 12, you see precisely the answer they got. What was the day when they're going to actually do this massacre on the Jewish people? It's the 13th day of the first month. Now, for any Jewish person, that would be a very significant day. The 13th day of the first month. Because the following day, the 14th day of the first month, was Passover. That was the central Jewish feast. And what happened at Passover? The Exodus. The escape from Egypt happened. So in the middle of this terrible, evil, demonic plot, where this madman wants to kill all of them, God is speaking. If he saved the nation from destruction under Pharaoh, surely he can do it again under Xerxes, can't he? What's the story? Rejoice, the Lord is king. His kingdom cannot fail. You know, there's these stupid, evil people there, but God is in charge. He rules over heaven and earth. The keys of death and hell are in his hands. Look for a minute at the plot and how Haman persuades the king. Verse 8. These people are dispersed. They're everywhere. You never know where they might find them. The implication is these people are out of control. They're dangerous. And then they're different. Their customs are different from those of the people. They're different. They're not us. They're them. When we start calling people them and they and start seeing them as individuals, that's dangerous. The implication is we're normal, they're not like us, they're abnormal, therefore we need to get rid of them. True, they have different customs. And then they had what's probably a blatant lie. They do not obey the king's laws. These are bad people. They're all criminals. Some of them might be bad people. All of them? No. There's an exaggerated conclusion to get rid of them. It's in the best king's best interest not to tolerate them. And those attitudes, you know, these people are different, these people are bad, these people shouldn't be tolerated, send them home, actually are alive and well in our own community. You can easily find them on local Facebook pages and in our country today. What drives people to tell, believe these lies, be so hateful? This is modern history, isn't it? Beginning the First World War, the Turkish Empire massacred 1 million Armenian people because they were Christians. They were seen as a threat. In the 1930s, Stalin deliberately starved 5 million Ukrainian farmers to death because he saw them as a threat. In the Holocaust, 6 million people, mainly Jewish, died, but there were tens of thousands of gypsies, communists, gay people, and Jehovah's Witnesses as well, who were killed. And they were all killed because they were different or they disagreed, and people chose to see them as a threat and believed lies about them. Between 1975 and 1979, 1 million Cambodians were killed by the Khmer Rouge. In the Cultural Revolution in China in the 1960s, 1 million people died because they were the wrong social class. In Rwanda in 1994, 500,000 people died because they're members of the Tutsi tribe. In Europe in the 1990s, tens of thousands of Bosnian Muslims were murdered. Genocide is not normal human behaviour, but it is widespread. And it's done by people from all sorts of beliefs and backgrounds. There's something deeply rotten, potentially, in human hearts. And many of these evil acts were carried out, you know, by otherwise all ordinary human beings, people acting under orders. As human beings, we're not that strong. We need saving. These attitudes are not far from us now, today. So that's the problem. Let's go and look in a minute at what happens next. Richard's going to read us the second part of the story.